We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. willpledge.org. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In this hour of the program, we'll be talking about endangered species and trying to talk about two big questions. One is how it is we determine that a species is endangered, and then how do we determine that it has recovered to the point that we can then take it off the list. And one thing that we'll be talking about certainly this morning, a good kind of case study and our jumping off point, is the wolf, the gray wolf. For the first time in decades, it has become legal to hunt wolves in parts of the western United States. The gray wolf was put on the endangered list in the mid-1970s. However, efforts beginning in the mid-90s to restore their numbers have gone so well that now in some parts of the West, ranchers and hunters are again complaining. The ranchers complain about wolves killing livestock. The hunters complain about wolves killing elk. And in response, the federal government has lifted hunting bans on wolves in two states, in Idaho and Montana. This morning, we'll try to talk about some of these questions with our guest, Ed Bangs. He is the Wolf Recovery Coordinator for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. After working as a federal game manager in Alaska for 13 years, he moved to Montana and led the reintroduction of wolves into Yellowstone National Park and also central Idaho. He's published many papers and articles on his wildlife experiences. He's given literally hundreds of presentations on a variety of wildlife management issues. He's also examined wolf-human relationships in Mongolia, in Sweden, and Japan, and is very interested in the intersection of wildlife management and human values. He's joining us this morning by telephone. Also, I want to mention that if you're interested in this particular subject, you can read in great detail the laws that govern the endangered species and look at lists of endangered species in various states. All of that information is on the website of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And if you go to the homepage of their endangered species program, you'll find lots and lots of information. So that's one place you could go. But of course, questions on this program are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana is 333-9455. The toll-free line, 800-222-9455. So at any point here, questions are welcome. We do ask people to be brief so that we can keep moving, get in as many callers as possible, and we want people to be on the topic. But if you can do all that, your questions are welcome. 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. At any point here, questions, comments are welcome. Mr. Bangs, hello.
Hey, David, how are you?
I'm good, and how are you?
I'm good.
Good. I appreciate you giving us some of your time.
My pleasure.
And I expect we'll be spending a bit of time here talking about wolves. We don't want to make that the entire focus of the conversation, but I think it gives us a good case study. Maybe there are some other things we'll get into as well. As a kind of a starting out question, let me ask you this. How many, let's just say animals, because I know there are also plants. If I say how many animals are there that are listed as endangered, what's the number?
I don't know the exact number, but it's many hundred.
And that's and also, I guess we should point out that individual states have lists. The federal government has lists. So you could spend a lot of time just running down the list of threatened both plants and animals.
Exactly. I'm with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and the Endangered Species Act was passed in 1973, and we've been listing species ever since. And as you can understand, after a couple hundred years of abuse, there's a lot more species on the list than have come off the list. And so in addition to that, individual states also have lists of threatened and endangered species in their particular state. While an animal may be more common throughout the United States, some states want to preserve the natural diversity and the wildlife heritage of their state and do extra steps to protect species that are becoming rare.
All right. Let's talk specifically about the wolf, about the gray wolf. It went on the list in the mid-1970s. What was going on then at that point that led to that action?
Well, it's pretty interesting that gray wolves and humans are the two land mammals on Earth with the greatest natural distribution. And so wolves and people have been interacting with each other before recorded history. And so wolves and people, you know, that's why there's so much mythology about wolves. And in pre-Columbian, you know, pre-settlement times, Native Americans kind of viewed wolves as brothers of the hunt. If you're a hunter-gatherer, you tend to view wolves in a very positive way. You tend to admire their family loyalty, their good parents, spouses, their hunting ability, their beauty, their strength, all those kind of things. And if you're a hunter-gatherer, you try and emulate those qualities because you think those are really cool qualities to have. If you raise livestock, then you tend to view wolves as the animal that kills your livestock. And the real downturn for wolves, of course, was the early Christian church used the wolf as the symbol of the dark side of human nature. And so the Europeans that came to North America came from the areas that pretty much hated the wolves the worst, and we started to deliberately get rid of them in the Plymouth colonies. I think the first bounty was in 1620. And so we intentionally decided to kill all the wolves. And in the Western United States, we completed that job in 1930, and it is ironic that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service actually got its start as a federal agency and its first money from Congress to kill the last wolves in the Western United States. But that was a conscious decision by our society, and so we eliminated what was once the most widely dispersed animal in North America, killed them pretty much all in the 48 states except for a few that remained in Minnesota and a few that managed to hang on in Canada and Alaska.
So at the point when wolves were listed in 1974 in the region now that we're talking about in the Northern Rockies, essentially there were no wolves anymore?
There were no wolves. We killed. There was an occasional wolf that would come down from Alaska or from Canada, and it would be killed also. And so by the time wolves were listed in 1974, there were none left in the Western United States, and they had been gone for about 50 years.
Now, the effort to restore them to the Northern Rockies began in the mid-90s. It certainly was very controversial. I'm sure there were people who lived there who were not happy about the idea of wolves coming back. What was the thinking behind this restoration effort?
Well, I mean, part of it is under the Endangered Species Act, and this applies to all species, there's conditions you look at to see if an animal needs to be listed or not. And the question is, you know, with wolves, all those conditions were met. Was the animal currently, you know, historically there? The answer was yes. Could you recover them? And the answer was yes. And so we looked at how to best to do that. The real credit for wolf recovery really probably rests with the Canadians. They started restoring wolves in the mid-60s. And as a result of that, wolf populations kept getting closer and closer to Montana as they moved southward in British Columbia and Alberta due to protection from, you know, excessive levels of human killing. And then finally, in the early 80s, wolves started to spill over into Glacier National Park right on the Canadian border. And in 86, we actually had a pack naturally form in Glacier National Park. So wolf recovery really started in the early 80s and then culminated with a pack of wolves on the Blackfeet Indian Reservation and Glacier National Park in 1986. We accelerated that process by intentionally reintroducing wolves to good habitat in central Idaho and Yellowstone National Park and the surrounding area. So the idea behind it was actually discussed for many, many years. Aldo Leopold, who's kind of known as the father of modern wildlife management, in the mid-40s, he was published and quoted as saying, you know, we really ought to think about killing all these wolves. I'm not sure this is such a good idea. But, of course, by that time, he was one of the few that thought that large predators had a place in our world. And the calls to kind of think about whether we should kill them all or not were just ignored, and we exterminated them. But wolves, people have been thinking about restoring wolves since the 40s. In the 60s, Yellowstone National Park actually proposed to reintroduce wolves to the park. And, of course, Western politics being what they were, that idea was quickly squelched. But people and wolves are so closely connected through time, and wolves are so symbolic. The idea of restoring wolves to suitable habitat never went away, and Congress started getting directly involved in the late 80s, and that led to a series of studies, finally an environmental impact statement, and finally the actual reintroduction itself. So it's the American people and their desire for wildness and to kind of restore habitats and native species that caused us to reintroduce wolves and restore them to the western United States.
And it's been a success, provided, of course, that you feel positively about wolves. How many are there now in the northern Rockies?
Yeah, we've got more wolves in more places with fewer problems than we predicted. We do our official estimate in December of each year, and in December of 2008, we estimated there was 1,650 wolves in about 110,000 square miles of Montana, Idaho, and Wyoming. And so most of the suitable habitat is filled with resident wolf packs then, and wolves are doing great. They're a tremendously resilient, big-hearted species, and they're thriving in the northern Rockies. Whether that's a success or not depends whether you mind them eating a cow or a sheep now and then or competing with you for getting an elk for the freezer this winter.
Yeah. To me, I think it's really fascinating to take into account the historical experience and the way people feel about the animal and how that can influence this whole conversation. I'm sure that if you looked at the list of plants and animals that are listed as endangered, there aren't quite as many things that would cause people to have an emotional reaction the way that wolves do. And I'm really, really intrigued with this idea that some people would argue the way we think about this animal in particular is shaped by very old and very deep, and some people would say misplaced, fear, animosity toward this particular animal.
Right. Among animals, I've worked with grizzly bears and wolverine and all kinds of stuff in Alaska as a biologist up there for years, and a lot of other species. Wolves themselves are kind of boring, actually, but people's fascination with wolves goes back before recorded time. If you think about the many tribes, both in early Europe and in North America and other places, have their origin story, including wolves, as giving rise to their people. The Mongolian people believe that the meeting of the blue deer and the gray wolf gave rise to the Mongolian people. And those kind of stories are common throughout the world. And so because wolves are so much like us, they live in family groups, they defend territories like tribes do. They're hunters. The family members all gather resources and share those resources. They take care of ones that can't take care of themselves. It's very easy to project human values onto wolves, and people do that with relish. And if you like wolves, you tend to emphasize, you know, the brothers of the hunt and they're good parents and they're wonderful spouses and they're loyal and they're strong and they're brave. If you really don't like wolves, then you talk about them being greedy and wasteful, which, of course, are all human terms. And so what we try and do is project values onto wolves to make other people like or dislike them. And that is pretty unique in the animal world. And part of that, and the reason for that, of course, is that wolves and humans overlap throughout the world. And so there's no other animals that have had the close interaction for the length of time that wolves and people have. And that's why we have so many myths, either Mowgli or, you know, or Romulus and Remus being raised by wolves, or, you know, the Three Little Pigs and Little Red Riding Hood about wolves. So that's human nature to produce these symbols to talk about human values with other people.
Our guest, just to quickly reintroduce, guest in this hour is Ed Bangs. He is the Gray Wolf Recovery Coordinator for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. He worked as a federal game manager in Alaska in the Kenai Refuge for 13 years, then he moved to Montana to lead the reintroduction of wolves into Yellowstone National Park and central Idaho. And we have been talking here specifically about wolves, but in a larger sense, what we wanted to try to do is talk a little bit about endangered species, how it is we make the determination that an animal or a plant is endangered, put it on the list, and then at some point, how do we decide whether the animal should or the plant should stay on that list? Questions, comments, welcome 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I'm sure one could spend a lot of time talking about the process. You talked earlier about the basic questions you ask about an animal. Is it threatened? What are its numbers? And that seems to me that ought to be something that's not real hard to determine. And then maybe more difficult is the question, can it be restored? This whole process, from this point where you propose an animal to go on the list to the point where it actually goes on the list, generally speaking, how long does that take?
Well, one of the things about the Endangered Species Act is anyone can propose a species to be listed or delisted. And you do that by filing a petition with the Fish and Wildlife Service, kind of detailing the reasons why you believe that should happen. The Act, might start with that. The Act is very specific on how you determine whether a species is protected by this powerful federal law or not. And so you have to look at, is the species population likely to be threatened or endangered in the foreseeable future in terms of it disappear from a significant portion of its range? And so the Act has five things that it looks at. It looks at, is the habitat endangered? Is it in threat of being too many killed or overexploited by people for some reason? Are there diseases, parasites, other predators, competition? Is that what the problem is? So you identify all the reasons that this animal is in trouble or plant. And then you decide whether those things are going to cause that animal to either become extinct or likely to become extinct, which is the threatened category. And then once you make that determination, and the Act is pretty clear, that determination is made solely on the best science. So anyone, you, David, could write a petition to say, we think that the, yellow flower Kansas should be put on the endangered species list, and here's why I think that. The service has to look at that petition based upon the best science and make a determination within 90 days whether there appears to be enough information in your petition to warrant a full-blown scientific review. And so within 90 days, we have to do this 90-day finding. And let's say we say, it looks like, there's enough evidence that indicates that this may be warranted to put on the endangered species list. Then we have a year from that point to essentially do a thorough scientific review, go out for public comment, get other experts to comment, other people to comment, and then after that period of time, we make the determination of, this thing needs to be listed and protected by the Endangered Species Act and restored, or, no, it looks like, it may be a little bit rare here, but over here it's just doing fine. It doesn't need to be on the Act. So that whole process takes within a year, and I think the real beauty of it is that anyone and any organization can ask that a species be put on the list or that a species is recovered and should be taken off the list. And, of course, the Fish and Wildlife Service does a lot of that itself because it's, by Congress, is designated as the kind of protector for biodiversity and threatened endangered species in the United States.
Hmm. So who was it who asked for the review of the status, the protected status for the gray wolf?
Well, the gray wolf was a pretty interesting one because wolves were essentially everywhere in North America, north of what is now Mexico City. So wolves were everywhere, and we intentionally got rid of them. And the first list of just compiling what species may be threatened or endangered in the United States started in the 60s, and wolves were actually on that list. So it wasn't an individual that petitioned. It was a long history of looking at wolf restoration, both in the Midwest, the Southwest, and in the northern Rocky Mountains where I work. And that was on the list of endangered species when that was simply a list. It had no legal authority at all. And so by the time things started cooking along and the Endangered Species Act was finally passed in 1973, wolves, of course, had been recognized as an animal that was once very common, had become extirpated throughout most of its range in the United States. So it just folded right into the whole process, and the service first listed wolves in 1974.
Yeah,
actually did that ourselves.
My apologies. My question was not clear. Who asked that it be delisted? Now, and that led to the recent delisting.
Sure. There's been different requests through the years, but the service in the Northern Rockies, we initiated the delisting process because we are the ones that restored wolves. We had a recovery plan that talked about what recovery would look like and when wolves would no longer need the protection of the Endangered Species Act. So the service initiated this process in the Northern Rocky Mountains.
So you came to the determination that the numbers of the wolves had recovered to the point where, and you tell me if I'm wrong on this, that you felt that we're at the point where actually some control on their numbers in some places was appropriate?
That's part of it. Actually, wolf control has been part of the wolf recovery effort since day one. We actually removed killed wolves in 1987 because of chronic livestock depredations on the Blackfeet Indian Reservation when there were only about 20 wolves in Montana. We ended up killing like seven of them that learned to prey on livestock. So control of problem wolves has been part of the problem from day one, and since 1987, we've killed about 1,200 wolves in the northern Rocky Mountains because of chronic problems with livestock. But the population still grew an average of 20% per year, occupied all the suitable habitat, and recovered. So part of the wolf restoration program was a recognition that wolves can cause problems. Those problems need to be minimized if you're going to have public tolerance of wolves back in these environments where people live. And I think the big success story in the northern Rocky Mountains is that last year we had about 1,650 wolves. Only 150 of them lived in national parks. Most of the wolves live around people, their livestock, their pets, their dwellings, their roads. And so it's that coexistence that really is the success of the Endangered Species Act. But we recognized that wolves no longer need the protection of the Endangered Species Act. And the question isn't, you know, did the Endangered Species Act work or not, because of course it did. The question is, into the future, what's the best way to manage wolves? And clearly, the great success stories in North America are with black bears, with mountain lions, with deer, with elk, with moose. And those animals have been managed by the state fish and game agencies and the tribes, which have included a public harvest, which gives people a chance to buy a tag, hunt an animal if they want, if there's a surplus in the population, and contribute money to fund that management. So we think that's the most appropriate management for wolves into the future. And legally, wolves no longer meet the purpose of the Endangered Species Act. They don't need it.
All right. And just to be clear, what is happening now, that it has become legal to hunt the gray wolf in Montana and in Idaho. There are quotas on the kills for both states. A license is required. So the thinking is that limited hunting should not have an adverse effect on the population of the animals as a whole.
Oh, exactly. And what's happened in Montana and Idaho, wolves are delisted. They're managed by the state fish and game agencies. They decided to sell tags to harvest a limited number of wolves. I think it's 220 in Idaho out of a population of roughly 1,000, and 75 in Montana out of a population of roughly 600. And so hunters have bought about $700,000 worth of wolf tags. There can only be a very limited number of wolves killed by hunters. And the idea is that it's much better to have a hunter pay money on the opportunity to harvest a wolf, and that wolf is most likely going to be a wolf that's the boldest, stands around out in the open, is in areas with a lot of human access, which are the very same wolves that are most likely to kill livestock. So it's much better to have a hunter pay for that opportunity and remove a few wolves that way, surplus to the population, than having me or a guy like me jump in a helicopter to shoot a wolf after it's killed somebody's livestock. So there's a lot of positive benefits to citizen participation in the wildlife management. And so, yeah, the limited hunt won't affect the population at all, but it does make wolves much more palatable because it tends to reduce damage.
Right. We have a caller here, someone in the Morris-Seneca area on our toll-free line, line four. Let's talk with them. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. I like this. I love your guest there. I'm from the Northwest originally, so I know what it's like out there, but I find it interesting out here in Illinois that we build these huge housing tracts and then we mow over all the coyotes, you know, all the wildlife, and not expect them to come back. And right now there's a lot of paranoia surrounding these coyotes where I'm at. They've had to call the police department, the animal control people, and, I mean, they're so skittish of people in the first place. It's ridiculous, but we, you know, the people bring it on themselves. And what I don't understand is that they're placing this almost like bounty on these coyotes, on deer, on possums, on every piece of wildlife out here. Oh, but then they'll take their kids to the wildlife center down the street. So it doesn't make sense, does it?
Well, you got some thoughts on that, Ed?
Well, I guess, you know, might makes right, and people have the power to destroy the environment or manipulate it or do anything they want. And so I think the Endangered Species Act is our society's attempt to define what wildlife means to the quality of American life, of our way of life. Because once a species is gone, that's an irreversible act. You can never bring them back. And so I think the point is well made, is that a lot of times we focus on these charismatic megafauna like wolves or grizzly bears or whatever. But there's a lot of natural diversity in all the states, and there's endangered species in every state, and those can be plants, small animals, but certainly these big charismatic things are the ones that gather the headlines. One thing about coyotes is that they've benefited the most by the extirpation of wolves, because wolves tend to control coyote numbers or at least restrict their distribution. And when you did away with wolves, all of a sudden you've got this expansion of coyotes, which kind of, you know, the weed to the canine world, I guess. Coyotes are everywhere, and they're causing some problems, both, you know, a few attacks on people, but certainly getting a lot of small pets and that kind of thing. So, and that just shows the ripple effect in the environment, too. So, but I think the Endangered Species Act, getting back to that, is our society's attempt to talk about what wildness and wildlife and natural diversity and ecosystem health means to our quality of life in America.
I agree, and I think it all comes down to education of people on this. Having been a wildlife specialist in forestry, I loved it. I kind of wish I could bring the parts and the things that I've seen in my past to the people here in Illinois and other places in this country so they can understand, you know, what is really going on out there, because there's a lot of misinformation out there. Yeah, thanks.
All right. Well, just one kind of general point that I think it'd be good to make, and that is we have talked about wolves, for example. That was an example, and there are others, animals that became threatened, endangered, and maybe even extinct because they were hunted. You know, that it was the deliberate act of human beings in that way that led to their being threatened. In what case, though, in how many cases is the reason for animals being endangered habitat loss? Now, that's, again, that's the result of human activity, but it's not maybe as direct. We may not see it as directly as those cases where something, and certainly it's happened over American history many times, something's been hunted to extinction.
Right. I guess the key is there is really hunting, I don't think, is ever, in terms of how we think about hunting in the modern age, caused the extinction of a species. Hunting is normally fair chase, sportsmanlike, surplus, closely regulated by science, all that kind of stuff. But certainly the unlimited and unregulated killing of wildlife has contributed to the demise of several species, passenger pigeons, for example, or others. But by far the biggest problem that most animals face is the degradation of habitat, of people just turning what was once grasslands into cornfields, or what was once a riparian area into a shopping mall. And so human conversion of the habitat is by far the biggest cause of endangerment. But there's a lot of others. Some animals are now endangered by the importation of exotic weeds or other animals. Sometimes pesticides have been involved. That's what endangered the peregrine falcon. And once that issue is resolved, peregrine falcons are doing fine, and they've been delisted, actually. And so it's just the overwhelming development of the habitat and changing the habitat to benefit people at the cost of other species that is really the biggest problem in wildlife restoration and biodiversity today, is this chopping up of the habitat and conversion to things that solely benefit people.
Let me introduce again the guest for this part of Focus 580, Ed Bangs. He is the Gray Wolf Recovery Coordinator for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. He worked as a federal game manager in Alaska for 13 years, then he moved to Montana and led the reintroduction of wolves into Yellowstone National Park and central Idaho. He's published many papers and articles on his wildlife experiences. He's given many presentations on a wide variety of wildlife management issues. He's also examined wolf-human relationships in Mongolia, Sweden, and Japan, and is very interested in the intersection of wildlife management and human values. We're talking about endangered species this morning, and trying to talk a little bit about what causes a species to become endangered what's the mechanism for putting them officially on the endangered species list? And then how do you go about deciding that an animal has recovered to the point where it can be removed from the list, it can be delisted? Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the grizzly bear in Yellowstone. And here, as I read about it, here we have a case where the animal was listed, then it was delisted by the Bush administration after their numbers had increased, and then now just recently has been relisted. This by the action of a federal judge in Montana. And, you know, that makes me wonder to what extent this decision about whether an animal is threatened and at what point it's recovered, how much of that is really a kind of a judgment call?
Well, I think it's important to remember that the Endangered Species Act and wildlife restoration management and the recovery of a species is the blend of three things. It's the science and the biology. It's the legal technicalities or the purpose of the Endangered Species Act and the associated laws. And it's about politics and, you know, the policies, you know, what is a significant portion of range? What did Congress intend when they talked about a distinct population segment? It's all these kind of political policy interpretations. So it's the melding of those three things. So you can have the biology like we do with wolves or grizzly bears, just rock solid. You know, grizzly bears in the greater Yellowstone area are doing great. There's nothing that's going to threaten them in the future. But that is just one part of the puzzle that can lead to a proposal to delist, which we did do. And the court found that some of the legal technicalities of the Endangered Species Act we may not have met. And so the judge says, boy, until you address these things, I think wolves or bears ought to be put back on the endangered species list. So the science and the biology is the really easy part on this, is the human dynamics and what did Congress really mean that becomes quite difficult sometimes. And I'd like to point out that, you know, the Endangered Species Act has been in place for, 35 years now. We haven't had the chance to delist many species because after 200 years of abuse, it's kind of understandable why it would be tough to restore something within just a few years. But as we go through the process, we're learning more and more about not only the science and the biology, but, you know, what did the Endangered Species Act really intend? What do these different terms mean? How to cross all the T's and dot all the I's? And Congress is wrestling with this issue because some Endangered Species Act issues become very controversial because of the perception that they're stopping human development or these kind of things.
Yeah, I looked at the numbers of animals that were delisted, and I think that I just looked at animals that were delisted, and it looked to me like, and we've talked about the fact that there are hundreds that are on the list, that if you look at those animals that were, there were some that were actually delisted because apparently they were determined to be extinct, but Those animals that were delisted because the determination was that they had recovered was maybe about 20?
Yeah, if that. There's been some lately because we've been getting online with better monitoring and species have been recovering. Yeah, I mean, and it's no surprise, you know, after 400 years of abuse to get them to this point where, you know, now we want to recover them, it's tough to do. And it takes time for some of these populations. And some of the problems are immense. You have exotic competitors brought in from Asia or overseas that are competing, exotic diseases. You know, humans have, you know, settled most of North America. And so some of the problems are very difficult to resolve and reverse and restore viable populations. Fortunately, a few areas in the West have these immense areas of public lands like the greater Yellowstone area, the wildlands of central Idaho. And you can have these large predators back like grizzly bears and wolves, mountain lions, black bears, where in other parts of the country it's been so modified that we clearly know that you'll never get wolves restored to Kansas, you know, unless you just, you know, turn it back into prairie, put bison out there and move everybody out. And we all know that's not going to happen. But we do have areas where wolves can be restored or other animals. And so I think the most interesting thing about that is our country still wrestling with, you know, what kind of biodiversity do we want? How much do we want it? And what are we going to trade off to have it? and what are we going to give up to, you know, essentially prevent an animal from becoming extinct. And our society wrestles with this both in its laws and its politics. And fortunately for me, the job of the Fish and Wildlife Service is just to do the best science. But that's only part of the problem.
We have some callers here. Let's talk next with someone on a cell phone on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Yeah, hi. First of all, thanks very much to your guest for committing his life to this service. That's fantastic. My question, and you answered part of it, I wondered how many animals were on the endangered species list, and I think you said just a bit ago that there were several hundred. I wonder if you could identify some that are near successes and may come off in the next, you know, 5 or 10 years, but also identify some that we're having a very difficult time with that are actually still headed toward extinction. I'll hang up and listen for the answer off the radio.
All right. Can you do that?
Well, I think some of the success stories are certainly, you know, that have already been delisted, the American alligator, the bald eagle, the peregrine falcon, kind of these big charismatic megafauna. But there's been some success with butterflies in California, plants in the Midwest, those kind of things that are slowly, you know, as we develop more conservation agreements, better understand the condition of the act, that may come off. So I think the future of endangered species conservation probably won't be these big charismatic megafauna as much, but it'll be more like locally endemic animals that, you know, only occur in a few bogs in western Montana, those kind of things. I think some animals are going to have a really tough time. The answer, you know, the red wolves, for one example, is a kind of the original North American wolf that lived in the southeast United States. Those animals readily hybridized with coyotes because of a shared taxonomic genetic evolution together. And it's going to be very, very difficult, if not impossible, to get those animals back because now coyotes, which are the reason, you know, in addition to human persecution, that red wolves were in such trouble, are everywhere. And so the red wolf niche has been taken over by this other animal that is going to make it very, very difficult to ever restore them. And there's other situations where either water quality has changed. Certainly the issue of global warming is going to have a huge impact on many species in the United States because the Earth is heating up so fast. So if you're a moose in the lower 48 states, the southern extent of your range is determined by the number of heat days. And as the Earth heats up, that means that animals that need colder weather or longer winters are going to have to move farther north into Canada or higher up on the mountain to get that cold weather. And that means they're going to run out of habitat in the lower 48. So I think global warming will probably affect a lot of species in the future.
Okay. Next to a caller in Champaign, line 1. Hello?
Yeah. Good morning.
Yes.
Before European settlements, how many wolves were in the North America? I mean, I picture a lot of wolves in the ecosystem.
Does anybody know what that number might have been?
Yeah, we've actually done some guesstimates, I like to call them, where you go back and look at genetic diversity and number of alleles and project at what kind of population it would take to support that. And the estimates are that there were probably 400,000 wolves in the western United States and Canada and Mexico historically. So wolves were once incredibly common. And the number of wolves is dependent upon the number of prey. So if you had, you know, 60 million bison running around the plains, that supported a heck of a lot of wolves. And so wolves were in the hundreds of thousands of animals for sure, and distributed from everywhere in North America, essentially.
So there'd be one running around Champaign County in a grassland?
Absolutely. Wolves were native to the entire, just about, wolves are one of the most adaptable animals on the planet. That they lived in tundra, grasslands, forests, they live in the far Arctic, they live about everywhere in North America except the extreme desert country and the very tip tops of some mountains. But they were certainly running around the Midwest and Illinois, Ohio, everywhere.
And is it true, I mean, when you listen to the rancher or the sheep herder, that the reason they want to get rid of all the wolves is because they are attacking young and, a profit center for somebody in the cattle business? Is that a reality or is that more hyperbola?
Well, I think you certainly have some cattle producers that would, you know, they'd come up to me and go, you know, my granddad killed the last wolf in this county. Are you telling me that he was wrong? And the answer is no, I'm just telling you the times change and people value different things now. But clearly, the ranchers I know, they don't mind having wolves around. They just don't want to feed them their livestock, which I think is a pretty reasonable thing. And so we work with them to try and minimize depredations. But clearly, if it was your livestock being killed, you would want something done about it. And that's why we've been pretty aggressive with control of problem wolves, is to minimize the conflict. So I think livestock producers have a legitimate beef. And any time you go into Endangered Species Act issues, whether it's a farmer or a rancher or a person that wants to put in a shopping mall or develop a beach condo or those kind of things, and all of a sudden you tell them, man, this is the last place this beach sparrow lives, you can't build a house here. That person gets pretty irate at that. So that's one of those trade-offs that society makes for the good of all of us and biodiversity and our quality of life. There's some things that people can't do. You can't be dumping mercury into the atmosphere. You can't be throwing arsenic into the lake. You can't be killing or cutting down the last habitat of this very rare bird or animal. And so the whole Endangered Species Act, I can understand why ranchers, you know, the ones I know don't mind having wolves around, actually. I think they're kind of cool, as long as they don't have to feed them their livestock. And if everybody was that reasonable, I think that Endangered Species Act recovery would be a little bit easier to do. But, of course, someone else's problem never seems that big. But when it becomes your problem, you know, then you fight tooth and nail. And that's the problem the Endangered Species Act has.
I had one other quick question. Polar bears, are there more of them today than there has been? I mean, it seems like that's the big scare thing with global warming. But today, if we looked at polar bear populations, are they up, down? And are polar bears in the southern hemisphere or just the northern hemisphere?
Polar bears are just the northern hemisphere. They're around the whole pole. Polar bears are one of the animals that are going to be impacted dramatically by global warming. There's still a lot of polar bears. There's not as many as there used to be, and the populations are predicted to go down farther because their habitat is essentially the sea ice. And as the temperature warms, the sea ice over the shallow areas decreases, which means polar bears' habitat disappears. So polar bears will certainly be impacted. There's less now than there was historically, and there'll be even fewer in the future. And that is one of the kind of the – but that's one of those charismatic megafauna. Global warming, and I mean, which is a result of lots of people doing lots of activities. It's you know, the whole human population issue, basically, and the fact that we all want to drive a car and have, heat in the house and all that kind of stuff. They're going to be impacted, and it's certainly a very charismatic animal to kind of carry the flag, but there's many, many, many other smaller, less obvious animals that are impacted by the impact of people on the earth.
We have about 7-8 minutes left in this hour of Focus 580. Just again to quickly reintroduce the guest. We are talking with Ed Bangs. He's the Gray Wolf Recovery Coordinator for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. He worked for a long time as a game manager, federal game manager in Alaska. Then he moved to Montana to lead the reintroduction of wolves into Yellowstone National Park in central Idaho. And we have spent quite a bit of time talking about wolves, but also, well, in a larger sense, trying to talk about the issue of endangered species and what's the mechanism for determining that one is endangered. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Here's a caller in Gibson City, line 2.
Yes, hello.
Mm-hmm.
I have a question, and I'll hang up and listen. I was just wondering, after listening in 200 years, when you mentioned 200 years in your talk, I was wondering, how involved are the American Indians in determining, you know, the different situations? And I will hang up and listen. And thank you for what you do.
Okay.
Sure. The tribes are getting more and more involved in wildlife management, not only for game resources, but also endangered species issues. Some of the tribes have more resources or are more involved than others. The way it works, and maybe use wolves as an example, the Nez Perce tribe in Idaho, we transferred management authority over to them in 1996, and they did a stupendous job of managing wolves in the whole state of Idaho for nearly 15 years. And so some tribes are much more involved than others. But I think the idea of the natural environment is certainly more tied spiritually to Native Americans than maybe Europeans. And some tribes have been active. The problem some of the tribes face is they don't have the resources on their reservation lands that they would like to do as good a job as they could do. But they are involved about it, and culturally, one of the big parts, I guess, that touched me most deeply in the whole reintroduction effort was we had a load of wolves in Missoula, Montana, that we were going to put in central Idaho within the ceded lands of the Nez Perce tribe, and they had a spiritual leader come out and kind of do a welcoming back ceremony for the wolves. And it was certainly a different way of looking at it, and they were welcoming their brothers back into their homeland, and it was pretty touching. So I think the tribes certainly have a big contribution to endangered species management, and tribal lands contain millions and millions of acres of prime wildlife habitat. So I think they're working on it.
We talked earlier about the fact that the recovery effort had been successful to the extent that the numbers had come up to the point where the judgment was made that some it would be appropriate as a part of the natural control for there to be some hunting, and that you said you thought it'd be better for hunters to do that and to pay for the privilege than for you to get in a helicopter and have to go out and fly someplace and shoot one problem animal. So now it's legal to hunt the gray wolf in Montana and Idaho. You got to have a tag. There's a quota. What's interesting to me is that it's sort of in the same area. There is no hunting in Wyoming. And I think some people have used that to question the hunt at all. What's the difference between the wolf populations in Wyoming and Montana and Idaho, and why is it okay to hunt in the two places but not in Wyoming?
Sure. Well, I think this is a good example of what the Endangered Species Act requires before species can be delisted. That for wolves, we have to look at everything that could possibly impact wolves. And the only reason wolves disappeared was excessive human persecution, killing of wolves. The only reason they recovered was we regulated that human killing of wolves so that wolves could come back and function. The only thing that would threaten wolves in the future would be unregulated killing of wolves over a large area for a long period of time. So we asked the states who regulate causes of wildlife mortality, how would you manage wolves if we went away? And the state of Montana is we'd manage for over 400, we'd tightly regulate hunting, we'd blend them in to the environment, we'd do wolf control like you guys do pretty conservatively. The state of Idaho did the exact same thing in their state plan. The state of Wyoming's plan was in 90% of the state, wolves could be killed by anyone at any time, by any means, for any reason, in unlimited numbers. Essentially, it was 1880 again in about 90% of Wyoming. And, of course, that caused us to go, we don't think that's good enough. And so we kept wolves under the protection of the Endangered Species Act in Wyoming because we didn't think that they were going to regulate human-caused mortality enough to make sure that that portion of the population would be sustained. But the states of Montana, Idaho, and wolves are delisted in eastern Washington and eastern Oregon, where they're listed as endangered under state law and fully protected by state law. So the Wyoming thing was just a little bit of a glitch with them wanting a little bit more liberal killing of wolves than we thought the population should be able to sustain.
And I guess that gets at what, and we're just about out of time, but the idea that once an animal is delisted, that doesn't mean that you all at the Fish and Wildlife Service are done with them, that there is this responsibility, you have this responsibility to have some plan for their continued maintenance and also to monitor their numbers?
A really good point. The Endangered Species Act is full of checks and balances, all to guarantee that the decisions made benefit species recovery and its persistence in the environment. So before you can even propose an animal be delisted, you have to do this thorough scientific review of all the facts, the laws, the status of the species. You have to look at anything that might possibly threaten the animal in the future in terms of the foreseeable future. So some genetic issues went forward. We look forward 100 years. And so we made that determination. We have to go out for the best scientific peer review we can have. We have to go out for extensive public comment. We have to respond to all that scientific peer review, all that public comment, to make sure our decision is based upon the best science and knowledge that we can possibly get. And before we can even propose to delist a species, and as long as we propose it, that is open for peer review and scientific review and public review. Then after we make the final decision, we have a mandatory minimum 5 years that we have to maintain close watch over the actions of our partners and the status of the population to make sure it's never listed again or it's not in trouble and everybody's keeping their word. And in addition, forever, anyone or any individual can petition to relist the species if the commitments made by, let's say, the states aren't being maintained or if the population isn't being maintained above recovery levels. So the Endangered Species Act, when you go to delist a species, there are so many safeguards in place, you know it's never going to be in trouble again.
Yeah. Well, you know, we're at the point here where we're going to have to stop because we've used up our time. I want to mention once more, as we did at the beginning of the program, that if people are interested in deeper, more detailed answers to some of the questions we've talked about, they're interested in animals that are considered to be endangered and what they are and where they are, plants as well. There's lots and lots of information available on the website of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. If you go to the website for their Endangered Species Program, their answers to all these questions, you can look at the Endangered Species Act, look at what the legal process is for listing, and find out what's on the list, and look at some of the experimental populations that are being reintroduced. All of that is there on the website, so you can read lots more about it. And also, we want to say thanks to our guest for this part of Focus 580, Ed Bangs. He is the Great Wolf Recovery Coordinator for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And Mr. Bangs, thanks very much.
Well, thanks for having me.